Hey, you guys, this is The Mean Podcast, and I'm your host, Kristen Filipkowski. The Mean Podcast is where I talk to creative, curious, and ambitious women who are diving headfirst into the second half of their lives. Turning 50 doesn't mean it's time to fade into the background. It means we know what we're doing, and we're not afraid to do it. Hey, everyone. Welcome to another episode of The Mean Show. I just wanted to start off today by acknowledging the Black Lives Matter movement, and I wanted to voice my support for everyone who has been impacted by police brutality and the history of violence against Black and Brown people in the United States. Last week, when I was about to publish my weekly show, the protests against George Floyd's murder were in full force. I took a look at the 17 episodes I've published to date and counted how many featured a Black or Brown woman. There were only two, and with that, I realized I am part of the problem. So I thought, okay, I need to do something about this immediately. I held off on publishing the episode I had planned for last week and promised myself that to make up for my negligence, my next 17 episodes would all be with BIPOC women. I reached out to several such women in my network, but I didn't hear back. That's when it occurred to me that these women are a little busy right now. They're marching. Many are scared for their kids. I have two brown kids myself, and I'm scared for sure. I imagine they're working through lots of emotions. And on top of that, they've been dealing with a pandemic and a quarantine for the past several months. And as the protests enter week three, I'm guessing they're pretty goddamn exhausted. From the beginning of the Mean Podcast and Mean Magazine, I intended to create something inclusive. Now that I realize I've pretty much failed at that so far, it's up to me to change it. And I can't expect anyone else, especially a Black woman, to drop everything to help me with that goal. So I remain committed to getting many more diverse voices on the show. I can't do it as quickly as I wish I could, but I can start now. Please hit me up with any recommendations you might have. In the meantime, I do have a wonderful podcast for you, and though it feels remiss that it's not specifically about racism, I hope it will be a brief but welcome escape from the news cycle. It's also timely if you need a little self-care right now, because my guest this week is Christine Marie Mason, founder of intimate skincare company Rosebud Woman. Mason embodies everything I love about interviewing women in their 50s. She's got so much experience and plans to accomplish so much more. A few years ago, at a time when Mason had sold six companies over the course of her career and opened a yoga center in Hawaii, she could have easily kicked back and quietly ridden her 50s into the sunset. Instead, she got the itch to launch one more company. Mason is passionate about helping women feel good in their bodies, and she explains in our interview how her entire life and career has culminated in creating products to do just that. Rosebud Woman makes plant-based intimate skincare products to honor, soothe, refresh, and arouse. Christine is also an incredible author and speaker, and our conversation is wide-ranging. We talk about everything from the experience of flying during the pandemic to having three kids under three at the age of 22, while she was in business school, no less, to growing Rosebud Woman to $1 million in sales in a year's time. I really hope you enjoy. I'm so excited to introduce you all to Christine Marie Mason, founder and CEO of Rosebud Woman. Welcome, Christine. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks.
Yeah. And so where are you located? I think you said you're in Hawaii.
Yeah. 3 years ago, we were wandering around the world. I had sold my company in San Francisco and gone around the world on a walkabout with the intention of starting some kind of meditation center or commune. And we landed on the big island of Hawaii. And I have a farm here and a 28-bed meditation center, which is an awfully nice place to ride out the COVID situation, I'll tell you.
Wow, I can imagine. So that was my next question. How has this shelter-in-place situation been for you? It sounds like you've had a pretty, like literally a zen situation for yourself.
Well, I would say I live in Venice in the Los Angeles area most of the time now, because as the company's been growing, I found it too difficult to run it from here. We started it out here, you know, we're growing some of the ingredients out here. But last August, I had to return to the mainland. It was just crazy to do all these trade shows and events and interviews and all the stuff we were doing in production and launching new products. So I landed in Venice. And when COVID happened, that's where I was. We're fulfilling both from our warehouse and from the office. In the back part of the property has a little warehouse and storage area. And so the first month was very challenging because, you know, we're looking at all of the impacts of sales and our employees and all the people. And so I was really grounded in LA, but I had this surprising feeling of relief at the pace that we'd been running at, really to drop in and just do the core work and to nourish ourselves and to get a little bit more zen about what was happening in the world and look at the bigger meaning of it. Then I got on the plane on Easter Sunday and came out here. So I've been here for 5 weeks or 6 weeks now. And
I'm just really curious what it was like to fly on Easter. Was it empty flight or what was that like?
They were Hawaiian. So I don't know if you know this, but Hawaii, the state of Hawaii, basically stopped inbound visitors. And so even if you were returning to your own home, once you got here, you had to quarantine. So when I went to LAX, it was completely empty. There were maybe three or four flights going out. You know, so I went over to the gate. They're telling you, if you don't have a place to stay, do not board the plane. There will be police and marshals meeting the plane in Hawaii. And then we were, you know, masked and gloved, and we got on the plane, and it was every other row was one party traveling. And so you basically had this massive space to spread out. They didn't do any beverage service. Everything was disinfected. And then we landed. They took our temperature when we got off the plane. National Guard was there. And then if you had to show proof of residency. And then when we arrived in our homes, you stay in your own space for 2 weeks. They did an amazing job of protecting the residents. There have only been 17 deaths in the entire state. So we've been really lucky. People took it very seriously early on.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Wow. That must have been surreal.
Yes. It was all those things. I think the flight, like 97% reduction in flights or something like that. And so this sense of like what we took for granted and this readiness to just hop on a plane and go anywhere and do anything. Yeah, it's been a very strange time, but also not without incredible blessing and insight around the pace that we've been running unconsciously.
Yeah, I can only imagine. It must feel very strange in Hawaii without the tourists.
We went and did a couple of errands. Like, I'm only going into town once a week. And we went to one of our favorite beaches, you know, first the plumber and then Home Depot and then our favorite beach. And it's this beautiful little green tortoise. You know, you swim in and then there are all these little coves and there's hot water seeping up from underneath. And there were no tourists. It was all like local kids doing their lifeguard training, surfing a little bit on the short boards. Just people, like, it's got such a peaceful quality of being like self-pleasing, self-blessing in a way, a very whole feeling. But it's tough economically. Like, I think there's 36% unemployment now. So what you'll see is people really turning into their families. And as that economic question gets massaged a little bit, you know, it's amazing how loaves and fishes the whole situation is. Like how people are helping each other and giving to one another and taking care of each other. And some of the entrainment in the constant work situation is being minimized. Families are really showing up for each other. And yeah, it's strange. There's definitely no heli-tourism, like people flying overhead to look at the lava. There's none of that.
It must be very quiet.
Do you know how in LA the air got clean and there's coyotes, yeah, Golden Gate Bridge and all that stuff? It's the same thing, even in a place that's already beautiful. Like, it seems to be like 10 times as many songbirds and like just everything feels more like in tetracolor, you know, just brilliant colors, the sound of it, nature's more here. You're in San Francisco, right? What's it like up there?
Well, I live in a small town called Pacifica, which is right outside of San Francisco. I actually have not even gone into the city since the shelter in place started. My husband has gone in, and apparently it's very strange there apparently there are not enough services for homeless people, and they are the only ones who are outside right now. So apparently there are a lot of tents, and I think it's opening up a little bit. They just started allowing stores to sell curbside, I believe, or they're about to. Mm-hmm. So I think it's changing a little bit, but apparently has a bit of a Mad Max quality to it right now, according to friends who live there. So it's unfortunate, but I think it sounds like that will be a temporary situation. But I was thinking the way you were describing Hawaii and how things are being sort of rejuvenated with this, there should be like a month of like a stay home month, like once every other year or something, just to sort of learn from this experience and help everything rejuvenate. Like the waters in Venice in Italy apparently were like completely clear. And
so what you're talking about, this phenomenon of the self-healing system, like Paul Stamets, who's a pioneer in mushroom and mycology, you know, he's put out all of those like turkey tail mushroom supplements and done all the core research on that. He postulates that if we stop polluting, it would take the mycelium of the earth 3 to 5 years to clean the atmosphere completely. And like just how fast it rebounds. Like if you get sick and you fast or do like a juice and tea cleanse for a few days and you stop your body from having to digest and process all that stuff, you know how like it can run down to the unhealthy areas and rapidly heal them because it's not doing other things. That the earth is like that. It too wants homeostasis. It wants to heal, but it's like in constant cleanup mode. Give it a chance to stop processing in real time and see what happens. And I love what you're saying about doing it a month a year or something, a month every 2 years. I noticed, like I have a bunch of adult kids and a grandchild, and my daughter was saying how prior to this shelter in place, her husband is a drummer. He travels around the world and does these big shows, like 200 nights a year. He's in a stadium show, and she's got a design business. Whoa. And he's doing this, and they're constantly running around, like who's going to cover the kid, who's going to cover pickup and drop off, and you know, just trying to make it all fit. And I listen to so many of my friends who are just always trying to make it all fit, and suddenly they had to stop what they were doing. And he does a Zoom first grade morning call with his whole class, and then they do their home lessons. And he's got special Zoom with the art teacher and the, you know, the music teacher here and there. But for the most part, they're in nature, they're rested, all the adults are nearby. And she said the quality of her relationship and the quality of her parenting is night and day. Like, what have they been doing? And I don't hear a lot of people in the, like, I don't see that in the news a lot of this introspection around, like, what have we been doing with our life and days that it took this to bring our family into this beautiful bubble? And why didn't we do that before? And I think that might stick around, like in terms of asking, like, what do you want to keep when the world says it's okay to go back to normal? What might you change? I think that they're going to do a wholesale change in their life.
Yes, that's so interesting. Actually, in the previous podcast that I interviewed, which will go up, we're recording on a Wednesday, so it's going up tomorrow. The woman I interviewed, she's the founder of a telemedicine company. Mm-hmm. She said the same exact thing. She has two teenagers. And she said she keeps thinking about all of the driving to and from, all the appointments, all the activities that they did, the sports and the classes and the after school stuff. And she's like, I'm going to ask them after this is over to choose like one quarter of the things that they used to go to, like pick your favorite ones. And let's just really pare down because they're having family dinners and they're discovering their relationships. And I feel the same way. I have a 7-year-old daughter and I'm always driving to and from, and it's very stressful, like trying to get places on time. And she just walked in the room. So she's saying hello. Sorry.
In Hawaii, they have a saying, if there aren't children and old people present, it's not real. Isn't that beautiful?
Right.
Like they should, you know, if they're not in the room, like you're not thinking about them, then you're just in some sort of weird bubble that focuses on like the productive midlife person who's healthy or whatever. And just, it's a very, I'm glad she walked in. In fact, the fact that she walked in is exactly what I'm hoping happened with work, that because we've gotten all of these glimpses into the lives of our coworkers and our colleagues through Zoom. They have children, they have cats, you know, what's their environment? Like these are real people, not automatons or widgets that come to work to be productive. They actually, this is what people are dealing with all the time behind the scenes. It's giving us the chance to really see people more in their wholeness, which I think can go both ways. Like you have two responses happening in the workforce. Like one is, I see you in your wholeness. Whoa, I didn't know you were dealing with all that stuff. Let me adjust my expectations or feel more compassion or empathy or presence with you. And then the other one is this kind of companies that are installing monitoring software to watch their employees all the time and like monitor their productivity as if productivity was coming from constant doing. Whereas anybody who's been in a creative work in any point in their life knows that their best insights come in these downtime spaces where all of a sudden the new connections can be made, that the most brilliant work comes from relaxation. So there's just such an interesting organizational behavior thing happening. Like, are you going to trust your people and allow them to be internally and intrinsically motivated? Or are you going to try to control and monitor and efficientize them? I feel like companies are splitting in the way they're going with that.
Yeah. And it's interesting that having to rely on technology and work from home is actually humanizing employees because we're seeing these little peeks into their home lives.
Yeah, like real talk, you're hearing like how husbands, how people who live together are sharing the one desk space, how they're dealing with, you know,
right.
People aren't really set up to do this. So I do wonder, particularly in cities, right? Like you're in Pacifica, that's such a lovely little niche. People who have space to spread out and get away from the people they're sheltering in place with, so you have a little bit more individuation. But, you know, think about people who live in cities where your real estate that you're occupying is really small and you rely on public places, putting on your headphones and going to the coffee shop to do internet, going to a public park, going to museums. If people are going to stay in a more work from home situation, it fundamentally changes the real estate of the residence in a city. So we're going all over the map here, mm-hmm. but I'm really interested to see the long arc changes that come from this. And, you know, for me, the sense of I do dwell sometimes, like I'm a scientist and a technologist in a lot of ways, but I do dwell a good amount of time in the sense of like, what is the mystery? And that allowing for the mystery of how the heck did this thing happen at a time when humans could not will themselves to lower their carbon emissions, to keep a degree change in climate below a certain level. So what is the mystery? You know, oh, we're going to shut you all down for a period of time enough that your emissions for 2020 will be much lower. Even if we go back now completely for the rest of the year to normal, the emissions for 2020 are double the reduction that we had to reduce by to stop further degree change. I was like, that's amazing. So the mysteries that are happening around it and the whys and wherefores, I'm going to allow for the fact that there might be something bigger going on that is beyond the human capacity to understand with all of it.
Yeah. So I want to talk about some of your other experience as well. And we're going to talk about Rosebud Woman and your amazing company. It's an intimate skincare company. So we will talk about that a little bit more. But Christine, you're also an author and you've written several books. Mm-hmm. And when I was looking at what you've written, there was one that stood out to me called Indivisible, mm-hmm. that you published in 2018. And it takes on a whole new meaning now when you read the description of the book, because it explored why more people than ever live alone, why more people are feeling disconnected and depressed and alienated and angry. And I just wondered if you've noticed any parallels between what's happening now and when you were doing your research for that book and writing it.
There's so many things that are being magnified with this situation. So you'll notice that something can happen in the world and one person's response is, I'm going to make masks. And the other person's response is, I'm going to buy a taser and a baseball bat to protect myself. And so I'm very interested in like how the same stimulus produces a completely different reaction in any given person. And so if we've been inculcated into an idea that you're individual, no one's there to help you, you're a self-made man, you've done it all yourself, that the world is basically a dangerous place and you're alone in it, or that if you don't continue to produce all the time, that somehow you have no value in the world. If that's your core belief, it's magnified during this time. If your core belief is, something happened, I'm going to lean into my family, my neighbors, my friends. If I can't work, I'll do something else useful. I'll be of service. That is also magnified during this time. But unfortunately, for a large swath of the last 100 years, the message that you are what you produce and you're a lone sort of superhero has been one of the default messages in American culture, particularly for our men friends. They're having a hard time with it. And so when you look at the sort of like, how do you know that you have intrinsic worth and that you can band together with other people to deal with any situation that arises without fear? That's what I'm seeing happening here. And that's what came out in the book also, is that people were deeply conditioned.
That's very interesting.
That the space between us wasn't visible to people. You know, the space that is sitting between you and I, even right now in this communication, that there's something in that is always present and full. It's not an empty space. It's an energetic space. And that the more that I can feel that and the more practically I can witness it, like walk down the street and say hi to my friends, swap lettuce for apples with my neighbor, whatever that happens to be, the more tangible the non-transactional exchange is, like we're just doing this because we like to, we're doing it out of a willingness, the more of that there is in our lives, the more connected we feel. And so many things have been reduced to a transaction. You know, even what was supposed to be the sharing economy isn't sharing. It's turning what was sharing into a transaction. So a lot of modern life could be made more whole and healthy by a return to a humanizing of these transactions and connections, and examining our own, what's in our own being about our core cosmology, how we fit with other people and how we fit into the world and how we fit into nature, and examining those ideas, how we fit into all of those places, and starting to unwind those beliefs changes the way we interact with those things, with other people, with work, with culture, with nature. So I'm very interested in that question. Like, if you believe your nature, you're right, you have a right to be here, you're perfectly built in harmony with breath and sunshine, that you have a natural dharma, that others are there to support you, that you're here to support and celebrate others. If that belief becomes really embedded in you, then how might you show up differently in all the areas of your life? So that showed up in the book on transformative justice. If you believe that about, you know, people who have transgressed against society, that's showing up in Rosebud. If you change the core beliefs about what it means to be in a female body, how does that change the way you advocate for yourself and other women in the world? So this relationship between the inner life and the inner cosmology and how the world that you make with other people manifests is very sort of core to my life's work. Sometimes I can just run on. You have to like stop me or something if I get into a run on.
No, I love it. It's Well, I love what you're saying. And I did want to also talk about your, let listeners know about more of your experience, because it's just, it really is mind-blowing everything that you've done. And like I mentioned, you've written several books, you've founded technology companies, you have founded publications, you teach yoga, you have a center. Yeah. So I'm curious, how did this wide-ranging experience lead up to you founding Rosebud Woman?
You know, you could not plan your life, and the reality is so much stranger than fiction, and how beautifully it all kind of flows together. So my mom was murdered when I was really young, and I had this longing for family. And so I went to college at 16. I met my husband at 16. We're married at 18, and we started having babies right away. So by 22, I had 3 kids, was Phi Beta Kappa from Northwestern, and going to the best business school in the country with 3 little children under 3 at the age of 24 or something. And so I had a very early grounding. And so I was never intending to be an entrepreneur, but I started working for a global consulting firm after graduation, and there's no way they could adapt of their needs from me to my life with little children. And so I ended up starting my first company in response to wanting to contribute my gifts to the world and make some money, but also wanting to be a good parent. And so I sold that company. I had another baby, and I started that company, and I sold that company. And so I'm moving along through my life in a pretty, what I would call, default world. And then the first dot-com thing happened. And I met up with a classmate and we decided to create a supply chain exchange in the dot-com era that was very similar to the thing that I had just sold, but in a different domain. And we're going through all of that. And so now I'm learning how to build a venture-backed company. I'm working really hard. But in the background, I am approaching the age my mother was when she was killed. And my daughter is approaching the age that I was at that time. And I have like a mental freak out. And I ended up at that point starting yoga. So we're talking like 2000 now. I started taking yoga to calm myself and I fell in love with it. It like opened up a whole world of inner presencing and softness and acknowledgement that I could slow down and breathe and be without having to always be doing. And the yoga became this backbone of my spiritual exploration over the next 20 years, which took me into all kinds of places. Shaivist Tantra, Kirtan, singing, all of those things were an outgrowth of this exploration of what is the mystery. And so that's happening in the background as my kids are getting older. And then I'm starting companies, you know, and just doing my work life. And then in 2016, I was like done. I was going to be totally complete. I had met a man I loved. We're going to travel. We're not going to do anything. We're going to start this retreat center. But I just could not get this one out of my mind. I'd been making these skincare products at home, really sex positive, really body positive for women. I was like, I really feel that there's a company here. And we're sitting out here in Hawaii and I'm like, I've just got one more. I'm going to do it. And this one's going to intersect all of the emerging love for the feminine, all of these ideas around like your body belonging to you, your sovereign, around treating it with reverence and treating it with care and no more secrets and transparency. And we're going to build beautiful, coveted objects of desire kinds of skincare products. I can see it like fully baked. I could see it. And we're going to couple it with this conversation around like completely inhabiting your sensual, sexual, and reproductive life for you as a woman and breaking down all kinds of stereotypes and ideas in the process. So I set out to do that with first market research and then formulations with the best organic plant-based formulators I could find. And the package, everything about the company was magic. Like the right people dropped in at exactly the right time. 18 months after launch, we had already done like $1 million a year, you know, in trailing 12 months. So it was like a crazy start. People really responded well. I think it's the first company that I've done that marries everything that I love and believe in with the technical and practical skills I'd learned building the technology companies before that. So it's super joyful. And the team is amazing. They're like the sweetest people. One of the women who runs sales, she's the one who's like gone out and gotten us Neiman's and Detox Market and Goop and all the, those retailers. She ran a program before she joined us called Women Enough, which was all about this exploration of body positivity and accepting yourself and reclaiming your own body as yours.
Yeah.
It's everybody's got this infusion of mission in participating in the company. Yeah, that's how I came to that.
That's so great. You know, I actually, the reason why we're talking right now is because of her, actually, because isn't that Michelle?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because we obviously pre-COVID, we ran into each other at a coffee shop and we had met like many, many, many years ago. Mm-hmm. And she said, she was like, Kristen. And I was like, you look so familiar. And then one thing led to another and we were remembering how we knew each other. And then she told me about this company and I was like, that's amazing. I would love to learn more about it. And then one thing led to another. And I remembered her Women Enough program as well. So it's funny how things all connect.
I met her when I was running TEDx San Francisco. I did that for 4 years. She volunteered at one of our big events in at Yerba Buena Center. And then she went off and did a TEDx for women. It's all a very sweet intertwining where the only thing on the team that's a little strange and wonderful is my son, who was my business partner in another venture, decided to come over and help me as we were growing. And now he runs operations. And so the only thing strange was doing a women's intimate wellness company with your mother for him. And he just wrote the most beautiful piece on what I've learned working in women's sexual and intimate wellness for 2 years that I want to tell all my guy friends. So he's the only man on the team. It's trippy. He's become a real ally.
That's amazing. That's so great. I love that. I imagine it might get a little awkward here and there, but
it's so great for him, I would imagine. He's the person who'll walk into a room and say the most awkward thing and wait for a reaction anyway. He's a very big personality.
Okay.
Yeah. he's definitely
so he's up for the challenge.
Yeah, he's up for it. It's a growing sector. In general, it's not just that we're doing it, but if you look back 5 years, like this wasn't even a viable thing. And women have still had a lot of secrecy around it. So ironically, like the Me Too stuff and a greater and greater awareness of the porosity and susceptibility of this part of the body to anything you put in, like it's 10 times more porous than any other skin on the body other than the oral mucosa. We're seeing a whole new generation of even like things in the tampon category being organic, no chem, people really rejecting petroleum byproducts on that part of the body. So more awareness is creating a broad range of new entrants into women's intimate wellness that I'm really happy to see, but it's all brand new.
That's really interesting. So I'm curious about that. You mentioned that you did your market research before you launched, and I'm curious if women of all ages were interested in your product. I'm very interested in it because I'm, you know, in menopause at this point, and it's very needed. These products are very helpful to me, but I'm curious if all age groups are interested, or are you finding that women in their 40s and 50s are more your customers?
That was part of the core question, like, where's the need? Like, one thing I didn't want to do is create a need. There's enough things already that, you know, you're like, oh, do I really need lash extensions? Maybe.
Right.
But I wanted to make sure that there was something that we were addressing that wasn't making women feel like they were inadequate. There was an actual real need. So we did the research at 3,000 women, all age groups, 18 to 68, I think was the oldest person, although I could have gone older. What I'm learning about women in their 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s in their sexual and sensual lives in the last year is mind-blowing. We interviewed them and said, what are your top concerns? And then cross-correlated the data. So their top concerns were moisture, and that appears as an issue for women who are postmenopausal about 70% of the time, but it's still about 30% of the time for women who are premenopausal. Arousal is not correlated to age, sort of the stimulation, but it is correlated to whether or not you've had a vaginal birth and whether or not you've had sexual trauma. So whether the level of sensation that people could perceive in their labia and vulva was different, it wasn't related to age. Soothing and calming and irritation, like the need for, you know, if you have redness or swelling, that was not correlated to age either. It was more related to whether you did exercise like biking, yoga, anything that would keep that area damp, or you had a lot of intense sex. And so I learned different needs. So the only one that was really highly correlated to age was the moisture. What's the word I'm looking for? The tissue, like bounciness, like resiliency, elasticity. That's the word I'm looking for. That
elasticity. Okay.
Yeah, that those two things were correlated to age, and that's hormonal. But a lot of it, you know, we were saying that it's not just topicals can help, but I also really want people to do mechanical things like getting more blood flow and self-massage, because so much of the moisture question in this part of the body is about getting blood flow to that region, because the moisture is stored subcutaneously. And so the moisture, the blood flow comes up from underneath. It pushes subcutaneous moisture up through the tissues. It grabs all the secretions, and then that's what makes you moist and wet inside. And so without blood flow, topicals, great, but it's only a small part of the equation in some ways. So I'm encouraging, you know, movement, self-massage, as well as doing topicals and even more than that, changing your mind, you know, changing what you believe about your body. So yeah, the needs are there. I found a few more things that I'd like to work on. They take things that are in the lab, like better cures for candida, but you know, those will have to wait. Those need some serious financial support to go through FDA approval, and I'm not there yet.
Oh, that's a whole other ball of wax, right? The FDA approval process.
Yeah.
So I'm curious what you learned. You mentioned that you learned some mind-blowing things about women in their 50s, 60s, 70s. What were some of those things?
Well, this is such a good direction to go. Thank you. So basically, I was very interested after getting people's feedback on for the first year, even like just as we started selling, like how people were responding. We were doing all these women's circles around the country, and we'd also often go out and there'd be like a teenager and her mother, and then the grandmother would be present. So you get three generations at once, and the kind of dialogues were crazy in terms of how many things still persist around body shame or lack of knowledge over a couple of generations, like how it's passed in families, and also the other way that, you know, women who were open in the 70s, their granddaughters are open and know what they're doing. And so how we break through some of the familial patterns. But then we started to see like, the way the world generally perceives a woman is sexually awake, like she's had her period, she's sexually in her prime, she's in menopause, and that's it. Like there was no finer part, but menarche and menopause are points in time. There's some like pre-menarche things, like you're getting breast buds and your body's getting ready to have a period. And there's some pre-menopause stuff where you're kind of going through variations in your cycle and you're getting ready to stop having periods. But inside of that range of perimenarche and perimenopause, there are all of these stages of a woman's concerns in her sensual and sexual life, which have to do with, is she intending to have a baby? Is she sexually active? All of those kinds of things. You know, is she pre or postnatal? How does that fit in with her cycle? But after menopause, basically the data just stopped. It was like, okay, you're 52 and from here to 88, you're going to basically be this thing. And that is not true at all. There are all of these stages that also are nervous system related, hormonal related, cognitive, that like 52 to 65, 65 to 73-ish, 73 to 88, you know, that there are these further break, like sort of tranches of what your sensual life might be like. And the clitoris, for example, never ages. At 80, it's the same as it was at 20. It has 8,000 nerve endings. They're all still online and functioning. You can still have that kind of pleasure. And women do. You know, women are exceptionally physically and sexually awake and aware in their 60s and 70s, and then they tend to lose their partners. And so you have this incredible age. You're still available for sensual pleasure and for good feeling and touch, but there's no one there with you. And sort of the isolation of that and what happens and what's available from a self-pleasuring standpoint or a more non-sexual touch also, you know, not just paid massage, but how to create opportunities for non-sexual touch. When my grandmother was dying, when she was getting old and my grandfather had died, I took a massage class so that I could touch her without hurting her because I felt her to be fragile. But even that, like, give touch to your elders, you know, go and cozy up to your grandmother and give her a little massage and just like stroke her arm. And I'm talking about old grandmas. I'm not talking about like me grandma, 50, 60 year old grandmas, because those ladies these days, like 60 is definitely the new 40. You look at sort of like that Super Bowl thing, that 50 was not the 50 I watched. My 50 was definitely not my grandmother's 50, you know? And so I feel like as we're looking more, I'm doing a lot of interviews now with women in their 60s, 70s, and 80s to understand like what those stages are, how they can be further explained and defined, as well as with neuroscientists on the brain as it ages and people who are studying hormones and telomeres and things like that, so that we can get a deeper understanding of a woman's sexual and sensual life past menopause.
Wow. I'm so glad you're doing that kind of research. It's so important.
Another thing that doesn't get talked about a lot is 0 to 12. Like in that early, like you have a daughter who's 7. So if you start thinking about what does she have to learn between like birth and her first period so that she can own her desire, she knows how to say no, she knows how to say a full yes, she knows what she feels, what she senses, what tastes good to her, that she knows how to speak to adults in a way that allows her to set boundaries, but also be respectful when needed. Like all of those things about being a girl, about being like a young Artemis warrior girl, are needed so that when you come into menarche, you have the ability to do that to people who either would be partners or would be predators also. Like that, but that doesn't just like happen all of a sudden. You're 13 and now you know how to defend yourself or you know what you desire. That's built from birth. And so I feel like there's a whole other thing in momming around raising our beautiful girls that could also be addressed as part of a lifetime of empowered sensual and sexual existence.
Absolutely. It's so important. You got me a little teary when you were just saying that. It makes me emotional to think about, you know, her growing into her, you know, being, you know, responsible for her body and being able to say no, being able to say yes, to know what she wants. It's all so important.
My own daughter and two stepdaughters and three biological sons also. And I never talked to any of them about sexual pleasure. I was like, why is that? You know, we spend so much of our lives learning how to be good lovers, how to receive well, how to relax, but I would never, it's like a taboo, a transgenerational taboo. And I wonder if that's the same way in other countries and other cultures and tribes. Like there must have been a way that women passed that on to their daughters or fathers passed it on to their sons beyond the birds and the bees. But here there's like a layer of taboo in it that I don't like, but I haven't figured that out yet.
Yeah. Well, there's so much about women in general, females, young and old, that is taboo in our culture. Like when you mentioned there's, you know, menarche and then menopause is not even acknowledged half the time. I mean, people are very uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's totally tied to like you're past your prime, therefore you're useless, you know?
Yeah.
Nobody wants to talk about it because you're putting yourself into the bucket of old and then you're not sexually desirable. And if you're not sexually desirable, then you have no power in the culture. So this is all part of the waking up to the equal value of the female and the male throughout our life cycles. And when women step into this like more overt power, okay, let me like wind back a little bit. This is so exciting. So, you know, like when you met people who have no overt power, like before women had the vote and before they had economic power, the right to own property, they were still getting shit done, but they were getting it done covertly, like sneak power. And so sexuality and attractiveness and childbearing capacity and nurturing and a lot of these things, they've been a source of tremendous power for a long time. And so what you see as you come into more overt power, then those things can take their rightful position in the culture and be somewhat diminished in the way they're expressed relative to just being a person who's doing good and important things in the world, no matter whether you're sexually viable as a reproductive agent or not, whether your skin's firm or your skin's not firm. And that's a shift that is around the equal valuing of every mind and heart, not the transactional nature of women that we've largely been socialized to, the property aspect. So I'm so glad to see the dialogue around, oh, this is just another part of a life in cycles. And then after your periods end, you have what we're calling the free period. Like for me, this part of life is amazing. Like the 6 hours a day I spent raising kids is like not, and cleaning the house and cooking and doing homework and all of that stuff and like managing my moods and whatever, that's gone. I have incredible freedom to travel. I've, you know, made some money. I'm in a creative position. Like that was never possible in my 30s or 40s when I was in the middle of all of that responsibility, raising a family and working and keeping a house and trying to do good in the community, you know, much less trying to stay in shape. You know, so I really feel like this period of life is like the culmination of all of the things you've learned and experienced can be massaged into a great artwork. And the sense of like, oh, it's all downhill after the kids leave home. Not true.
I love hearing that. I mean, I'm in a bit of a different phase because I have a small child. You started super early. I started super late. But it's funny because in my previous interview, I remembered reading that term free period and I couldn't remember where I read it, but obviously it was from you.
Yeah.
I love that. I love it. I'm going to start spreading that and I'll remember to give you credit from now on.
I've been working since I was 16 and I'm 54. That's like the reason that looks padded and it with all kinds of weird, strange diversion. It's like that all happens over the course of a long life of being curious. And what I'm really encouraging, like people who are in the midst of childbearing, like I took 3 years off when my fourth child was born and just was like home and making things and enjoying him and contributing. And, you know, like there's periods in your life where you can just fucking back off and enjoy what you've got. Mm-hmm. And knowing that it comes in big, long arc cycles and that there's always another thing that if you're paying attention, that is bubbling up, that wants to be born. And it doesn't all have to be now. You live like serial lives. And a trajectory is not deterministic. Like just because you do one thing for a while doesn't mean that's where you're going. So I would encourage that, allowing for what's emergent and knowing that life has all these different waves, and not to put so much pressure on this moment right now.
And you mentioned you took 3 years off. Did that feel good at the time? Did it feel scary? Or, and did you do it because you just really wanted to kick back for a few years? Or did you, were there outside pressures that you felt were pushing you to do that?
I knew it was my last baby. And I really wanted to be there. And I'd saved a little bit of money and it was fine. This is sort of pre the yoga stuff. And I took the same neuroses that I was bringing into my unhealed wounds about the loss of my mom and my workaholism into being home. And so I wouldn't say being home was necessarily peaceful for me or my family. I think I redecorated the house 4 times and also like soaked clothes and like stenciled the driveway basically. So I just because you're home doesn't mean you're not busting your tush to do everything. You know, I think really valuable in that window was I was doing parenting co-ops with other parents. I was serving in the community more. I was much more embedded in where I lived. And my best friendships with other parents and other women were formed in that window. And that's the value of taking a break and being real and present. And that set the model for how I wanted to live in community. That something was impossible to do commuting in the morning, getting home, you know, feeding everybody, doing homework, tucking them in, and then doing it all over again. It was almost impossible to create relationships in the place we lived.
You also have mentioned a couple of times you seem to have like a pre-yoga and a post-yoga life. I don't know if that's accurate, but could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So I was really young when I had my first sort of experience of like the light. You know, I was maybe 7 or 8 when that first time happened. And I knew there was a lot more going on in the world than I could see. It happened again when I was around 14. Like I walked by a church and they were singing and every cell in my body sort of separated and got lit. And I went in there and I knew, like I had no churching in that way. I knew that when I was a parent, I would make sure my kids got that. And so I went through a period of like the only way of accessing the spirit a thing that I knew of was to go through a traditional Western church. And it was like a little bit satisfying for a while, but it was very dogmatic and patriarchal for me. And I couldn't say the words in a clear conscience. But during that window, I was introduced to a Jesuit meditation teacher, Wayne Teasdale, Brother Wayne, who taught us how to be silent and listen. And that coincided with finding yoga. So there's a sense of the yoga and breathing and being silent and listening and going into meditation that was much deeper than like the asana that they teach in, even though I loved that, and that it was a way in to the silence of the heart. And in the silence of the heart, you could hear a much bigger story of what it means to be human. And when you choose your, like, even if you're doing all your work or you're being in big relationship, that it was always done then after yoga and meditation with a sense of connection to something deeper. Like I always knew that no matter what I was doing in my work life, it wasn't the most important thing. The truth of my soul and heart could never be harmed, whether my work was good or my work was bad, whether I was doing $1 million in sales or I was doing zero, whether my house was clean or not clean, like whatever that was, it just really moved. And it moved from an enlightenment experience to an embodied reality. And what that means is you take this, for me, what happened by doing it with the asana and the yoga was I brought that experience into a repeatable practice where I could create it just through breathing and moving. And that then turned around and changed the way that I interacted with the world around me over time. And the last 5 years in particular, it's a pretty pervasive sense, like a pulsation of awareness that gets stronger every day. I have a beautiful teacher right now, a guy named Thomas Hubel, who, if you ever get a chance to study with him, talks about the importance of rest and reflection in your life. So he says Shabbat in the Jewish tradition and, you know, and the day of rest in whatever tradition was a day to reflect back on what was created. and that your meditation practice is in Shabbat and every day, like your formal meditation practice. But then it gets to this point where like there's a little tiny part of every moment, like a part of every hour, a part of every minute that is like oscillating in and out of being aware of the permanent mystery and the beauty of existence and the energy field you're connected to, and then going back into the moment. And so like a little Shabbat in every hour, every minute becomes like a state of being. And the more you practice your seated meditation, the more accessible that little oscillation becomes. So that's what's making the work so fun and the writing so fun. And that's where my energy comes from. It's like, it's pretty much sourced from that place. And so when I say pre and post yoga, that's what I'm talking about, is pre and post a really readily available access to the presence and the light.
Another one of the books that you wrote was actually, it was your most recent book called Bending the Bow.
Yeah, that just came out.
Yeah, just about 6 months ago. Is that correct?
Right.
It focuses on eight visionaries who were way ahead of their time, decades ahead of their time. And I'm wondering, what was your motivation to write that book? How was the seed planted? And I'm also wondering if there's anyone today who you think falls into that category of being decades ahead of their time.
Yeah. Thank you for asking.
I feel like you fall in that category, actually. Well, I feel like you should be the subject of a book like that, but go ahead.
This book, so I was doing, it was like the night of when Trump got elected. It was that night that the Indivisible launched, 2016, not 2018, Indivisible. But so I was like, how is it possible? I thought the world was on this march toward pacifistic, global tolerance, justice for all beings, getting increasingly colorblind and religion blind and gender blind. How is it possible that this trajectory has been interrupted by people who are like still hating on women and racist? No.
Yeah.
So I have this, like a couple of days of total dejection. And then I'm like, well, we can't get dejected because it's been this way through all of history. There was always somebody who stood up, you know, who fought for civil rights, who fought for children's rights, et cetera. Why don't you go and look at the people who were ahead of their time in all of these great movements and see if you can identify some common threads between them and then use that as a blueprint to sustain yourself through the next 4 years. So that was the origin of the book. And so in going back and finding, you know, I looked at I Am More Than My Gender, the women's movement, I Am More Than My Race, I Am More Than My Sexuality, I Am More Than My Age, and looked at people who were like really before it was in the common consciousness out there taking all the heat for daring to put these kind of ideas out there that women should own property and vote, that children shouldn't work 14 hours a day in a mine, and then look at who was around them, like what kind of pods surrounded them and those like how did they sustain themselves and what were their inner beliefs? And that's what the book is about. It sort of says, here are the core beliefs that those people have across centuries. It's the same. And here are the kinds of five or six people and roles that they're always around them in terms of resources and moral support and all of that stuff. And then I include in the book what I call like first and second generation movements, like the rights of people who are differently abled is probably in the third or fourth generation of change. And then animal rights is in the book as something that's in the second generation. But thinking that things take five or six or seven generations is the native version of that. But it actually pans out that you have these forward movements and then recursions from the dominant culture and forward movements and recursions. And I learned so much. It was like an alternate history. And so the current movements in the book, those two that I just mentioned, those have interviews with current leaders, Judith Heumann in the disabled rights movement. And Stephen Wise and the animal rights movement are part of are people who are doing that today. I think we've got some others that are happening, people thinking about like labor and economics. But for the most part, the most inspiring thing is that all of these people sort of come to terms with their position in time space, that they're going to die sometime anyway. Why not devote themselves to something that's larger than they are? And that's where they're sourced from. So it was really inspiring book to work on. And the friends that they get together to do it with are also really ordinary people, but somehow they like manage to coalesce into a little committed pod, and that together they become like just a super clean ecosystem, an attractive ecosystem that pulls people into their message. It was really beautiful.
So, you know, I could actually talk to you for, I'm sure, hours and hours. You've done so many interesting, amazing things. And, you know, most people would be thrilled to have just write one book in their lives. You've read many, you've written many, you've founded companies. And I'm just very curious, on a practical level, how do you do all of this? Like, how have you gotten all of this done? Do you have like a secret organizational skill or a secret source of energy that like enables you to do all of this?
I've done a lot over a long period of time. Like I was saying, that's really part of it, is just keep stay alive. Stay alive. And stay alive, stay curious. I think the meditation thing is real. I do this thing every year at the beginning of the year that's like, you know, kind of a goal setting life wheel practice. But one of the core principles is all of these energy drains in your life. Not managing your money well, having shitty relationships where you're arguing and like you're like in some loop in the middle of the night and fighting, having your health like off kilter because of lack of attention. The way that I view the world is your core daily practice, the center around which everything is built, is this connection to source. And then around that is this three-legged stool of your money, your health, and your core family relationships. And that once that is stable, you have this like pulsing energy source in the middle that anything can happen from. Not only do you fulfill your own creative projects, but you are able to band together with others and fulfill those easily also. But with one of those pieces off kilter, it's really difficult to sustain meaningful work. And that's not like always powered, like you're not muscling through. It doesn't like lift from the center. So I really encourage the healing of those things so that you don't have energy leaks around relationship, money, and health, so that everything else in your life can just be lit from within. That's what was the biggest movement for me, really taking out romantic relationships and friendship relationships that weren't working, and working on my own communication skills in that area, on my own triggers, my inner life, so that I could not have that drain. And then I'm really super conscious around my health and eating. And then in terms of the money, I lost everything in 2004, 2002, I lost everything in the dot-com bubble bursting. I lost my house. I had $4,000 and four kids to feed and no job. And I think that experience of learning how to live with very little, and then when I got paid again, I didn't go back to spending, and I really learned the practice of how to be in right relationship to money and spending in my 30s. And before that, I was not conscious of it, and I would just spend whatever came in thinking there would always be infinite supply. And now, I really would encourage particularly women and women who are interested in starting their own companies or in having freedom in their life to come into right relationship with their money and savings. And forget about perfecting your body, just stay really healthy and learn how to be in loving accountability in your relationships and watch everything else like fly in your life out of those practices.
Wow. Yeah, I want to be respectful of your time. But just to wrap up, could you tell us where you see Rosebud going in the next few years, and if there are any specific plans that you want to share with where it's going?
Yeah, I want Rosebud to be the bedside favorite of a million women. That everybody has it on their nightstand, and they reach in right before they go to bed and they give themselves a beautiful groin massage, labia, clitoris. They get themselves all happy and joyful, and then they rest and let it sit overnight, and they just feel so good in their whole body, and they reintegrate their pelvic basin. And out of this, I have a million women who are like totally in love with their bodies, have reintegrated, and from there, they step out and do cool political stuff to take care of women worldwide. That's one thing. I just want to keep growing. I want people to have it, to understand it. We'll add a few more products. I just have a new body oil coming out that's got exquisite ingredients that does like Shisandra and Pennywort and all these things that, you know, really heal the skin. And I'll continue to do anything related to body love and to the reintegration of intimate wellness into normal body care. So that's where I see it going. We were shocked to see like Neiman's picked it up and Nordstrom, but they picked it up in January and then everybody closed their doors for the duration. Mm. So we'll see what happens there. That's our best opportunity to really go and reach so many people. Otherwise it's, you know, e-commerce and talking to people and doing our best to get the message out there in the short term.
Right. Well, I'm very excited about the body oil. That sounds very, very luxurious.
I'll send you the body oil. We have like a body brush where you dry brush your body, going all the way, you know, like getting it all. Mm. And then you do the oil and you do an affirmation practice while you do the oil. Like you talk in your own language. I give you examples, but you know, you do it in your own words. That doesn't sound corny to you because I'm pretty corny and dorky. I'm like, oh, you're just such a fantastic woman. Look how you flex. You know? You're like, you talk to all your whole body while you're going head to toe and like saying thank you basically for functioning and being a good vehicle. So when it comes out, it should be out next week, actually. I'll send you some.
Oh, exciting. That's very exciting. Well, Christine, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. It's been so interesting. And I know that listeners are going to love this podcast. So thanks again so much.
Thank you. Lovely to talk to you. Give your baby girl a squeeze from us. And I'll look forward to connecting again. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for listening to the Mean Podcast. Please check out the online magazine at www.meanmagazine.com and get in touch if you or someone you know should be featured in the magazine or on the podcast.